we have discussed basically thermodynamics and the basics of statistical physics, and then you know, the thermodynamic description allowed us to describe phase transitions, but it was from a macroscopic point of view. It was rather, so you were not studying what's really happening with the matter, but you were interested, yeah, so under the phase transition from liquid to gas, the entropy jumps, the volume jumps, and so on. There's a first order phase transition, which is described by this Gibbs free energy, but you were not really interested in what's happening microscopically with the matter. And so, just to really stress what you mean by different phases, so phases have different macroscopic properties, have different. Oh, so okay, so today what I would like to do is start with introduction. Sorry for that. So just to give you some ideas how the microscopic description works. So phases have different macroscopic properties. But microscopically, they are actually described by the same physics. They are described by the same Hamiltonian. So this is actually took some time to, for people to understand that you can describe by the same Hamiltonian completely different phases. So you can describe by same microscopic physics, water, ice, or vapor, is the, but it's the same physics microscopically. Okay, but you have macroscopic properties are different for different phases. So typically you have, so what are these things which are really different? So if you have, for example, solid, liquid, and gas, so what are the macroscopic properties which are different? So the basic property of solid is that actually it is rigid with respect to shear. So if you try to do something to the solid, it actually has, you know, it will not allow you to do that. So this guy has rigidity with respect to shear. And okay, and liquid and gas don't have that, so you can form them whatever you like. And so how you distinguish sort of liquid from gas is that there's this defined interface for liquid, but not really for gas. So this guy has a defined interface. So you can think about, you know, distinguishing the microscopic properties of solid, liquid, and gas in this way here. And so gas doesn't have a defined interface. But we have seen yesterday that basically there is not much, you know, to distinguish liquid from gas, really, because you can always go around and make a continuous transition from one to another. And so there's no really jump in any properties as you are going in this continuous way around it. So anyway, so that was one example. Then basically, the example which we'll be studying whole next week is the ferromagnetic-paramagnetic phase transition. So ferromagnet versus paramagnet. So ferromagnet has macroscopic magnetization. This guy has macroscopic magnetization. And another example would be that you have, let's say, normal matter, a normal fluid, and superfluid. And so superfluid would be characterized by zero electrical resistance, and also superfluid tends to expel magnetic fields from it. So zero electrical resistance and expels magnetic fields. Yeah, whatever. Superfluid, superconductor, yeah. Yeah, basically the same thing for us. Yeah. Well, okay, if you want. Okay, so the microscopically, the physics is exactly the same. It's just one Hamiltonian describing both phases or three phases or whatever. But macroscopically, the properties, macroscopic properties are different for different phases. Okay, so now why are the properties of these things really different is the consequence of ordering. So there is, so this is a very important thing. So it's ordering. So for example, if you talk about solid and its corresponding property, which is the rigidity to shear, then this is a consequence of the fact that the atoms actually sort of order in your lattice, and they form a crystal, and so you have this ordering in the lattice. So rigidity, example, rigidity corresponds to ordering of atoms. In crystal. Okay. Similarly, if you have ferromagnetic or paramagnetic phase, so ferromagnet, you can describe that you have some spins in your material, and so ferromagnet has these spins aligned in the same direction. And so because you have these small magnets sort of align in the same direction, then you have a global magnetization, and then you have ferromagnet. So similarly, ferromagnet corresponds to ordering of spins okay, so these are basically the idea. It's really, you have the same microscopic description, but the ordering is different. So now, for, as I said, for today, but also the whole next week, we'll be just discussing this, the simplest possible example, simplest possible model for ferromagnet-paramagnet phase transition, which is described by the Ising model. So Ising model. Which is the simplest of ferromagnetism and which of course played a crucial role in the development of statistical physics. And it was already, you know, formulated in 1920, so it's quite old model, and not by Ising, by somebody else. But Ising was the first one who solved it exactly in one dimension, and that's what you will do in your homework. And I'll do something more simple in the lecture. But it was in one dimension, and then took some time to find a solution in two dimensions. People are still trying to find a solution in three dimensions. So even though that this is really the simplest model, it still hasn't been, you know, fully understood. Okay, so it's described by the Hamiltonian H, which is -1/2. And so sum over neighbors, I and J. They don't have to be necessarily the nearest neighbors. Sigma I and sigma j. So the spins are described by these sigmas. So sigma I describe the spin. And in this very, very simple model, they just take discrete values plus or minus 1. So sigma I is plus minus 1, whether the spin is up or the spin is down. You don't allow the spin to rotate smoothly around. It's a different model. So here it's only up or only down. Okay, and so JIJ is basically telling you, you know, how much these various spins interact in the lattice. So you have a cubic lattice, and then you describe various sides. So I'll have a side I here and side J here. And of course, this JIJ tells me, okay, if I'm close enough, these two spins which live here will still interact. If I and J is too far, so JIJ will be equal to zero and they don't interact. Okay, so sometimes people take the simplest model is that only the nearest neighbors can interact. So only, you know, if you are just next to each other. So for this spin, be this guy, that guy, that guy, and that guy. So that will be the nearest neighbor interaction. But yeah, and then it would be denoted by that. So this, if you put a bracket like this around these things, that would mean it's a nearest neighbor interaction. But let's just keep it a little bit more general, and let's allow these JIJ to be even for, you know, neighbors which are not the nearest neighbors. You can bother neighbors which are not necessarily only close to you, but you can bother some neighbors. Okay. So that's the Ising model. So as I said, in 1D, it was solved by Ising. In 2D, so 1D, Ising, in 2D, Onsager. Maybe you've had, and it's the most complicated solution ever of a simple model. And so last year, we basically, a lecturer showed the solution, and he spent like 5 lectures showing that this is the solution. So I don't think it's worth it, so we will not do that. But you will do this sizing model for the nearest neighbor. So now if you are in 3D, then nobody knows. And then if you are in 4D and higher, then basically the solution corresponds to mean field theory, which I'll introduce today. And so it's a certain approximation you do, but interestingly, it's exact when you are in sufficiently high dimension. So now this is a spatial dimension, not a space-time dimension. Okay. Okay, so let's use this model for this, you know, for today and for next week. And let's see what this model, where it leads us. Okay. So now, because we want to describe ferromagnetic, paramagnetic phase transition, we will probably have two phases. And so you can define a magnetization was denoted by M, and it will be the average value of the spin. Okay. And so you have two possibilities. It's either zero or not. So if it's zero, it is equal to zero, then, of course, you don't have global magnetization, and that means you are in paramagnetic phase. Paramagnetic phase. If it's not zero, then, so not equal to zero, then it's the ferromagnetic phase, and you have non-trivial magnetization of the whole thing. So now you will show that the magnetization graph looks like this. So this is the temperature, and this is your magnetization. And so basically, it looks like it goes to 1 here, and then here it's 0. So now there is a critical temperature here, where the magnetization becomes 0. So for temperature smaller than the critical, so this is a critical temperature, and so for T smaller than TC, actually you have ferromagnetic phase, and for T bigger than TC of paramagnetic phase. Okay. Of course, at T equal to zero, all spins are aligned, because if you look at this thing, so if the spins are the same, so sigma I is plus one, sigma j is plus one, then your energy becomes more negative, provided that jij is positive. So you want to globally minimize your energy, so which means you tend to align the spins. So basically at t equal to zero, at absolute zero, all the spins will be aligned. You are in the ground state. You have the minimal possible energy. And then, of course, as you start increasing the temperature, and the temperature, you know, causes some fluctuations of these spins. And at some point, these fluctuations are so big that you lose this total magnetization, basically. So here, all spins are aligned. All spins aligned here. So now, notice this remarkable thing, which we already seen, you know, by thermodynamic description of this, these things, is that something is non-analytical. So this magnetization, you know, is nice and smooth all the way up to here, but then, you know, it ends here, and then it's zero after that. So it means it is non-analytical solution, because of course, if it were analytical, I take this point here, I do Taylor expansion, but all the derivatives are here equal to zero, so I will never have a non-trivial function over here. So phase transitions are inherently connected with something being non-analytical, something not being smooth enough. So you have some catastrophe theory, which we discussed yesterday. Okay, so now notice that there is some discrete symmetry to this Hamiltonian. So there's a discrete symmetry and so your Hamiltonian remains invariant if you change all the spins to minus all the spins. So H is invariant under change that you change all sigma I to minus sigma I. So now that's the symmetry of the Hamiltonian. But if you look at this solution here, I have just chosen that the magnetization is equal to plus one. Okay, so it's plus one, not a minus one. So actually, in the ferromagnetic phase, the system randomly chooses, I want to align all my spins up, or I want to align all my spins down. That's a random choice. But once the choice is made, you actually stay in that phase, sort of. So actually, the solution, in the ferromagnetic phase, you break this symmetry. And because it's only randomly chosen, this is called spontaneous symmetry breaking. Okay, so in ferromagnetic phase, this symmetry is this symmetry is spontaneously broken. Sorry?
Do people know why the symmetry is
broken? What do you mean, why it's broken? It simply is broken. I'll elaborate on this a little bit more, so what it actually means. So it just waves your question. Yeah, your ferromagnetic phase sort of randomly chooses whether I am aligned up or whether I am aligned down. And so actually, this spontaneous symmetry breaking exactly corresponds to the fact that you can choose this order parameter. So this is related to the order parameter. So now in our case, I said that now our spins align and they form some kind of order. Of course, this order is precisely described by this M, by this magnetization thing. So in our case, the order parameter is M. And so the fact that you can get non-trivial M, align, you know, breaking the symmetry, corresponds to what happens here. Okay, so, and this is a much more general statement. So basically, in any phase transition of this type, you know that the existence of the parameter is tied to some kind of spontaneously broken symmetry of your Hamiltonian. Okay, so far questions? So now, what I was saying is not entirely true. I said the system chooses one, you know, aligning up or aligning down, and then it stays there forever. It's actually not entirely true unless you take thermodynamic limit. So let me do this very simple calculation, very simple exercise. So consider external magnetic field. So you can upgrade your Hamiltonian. Now, so this is without magnetic field, but of course the spins do interact with the magnetic field, and the Hamiltonian now becomes whatever we had before, J sigma I sigma J. This is what we had before, but minus the interaction of the spins with the magnetic field. And we shall use this later on. So we have, but now let us also consider that we have in our lattice is finite, and we have n sites in our lattice. So external magnetic field, and then n sites. So we have a finite system. Of course, then we want to send this n to infinity eventually, so making the system sufficiently big. But let's just do it for a finite system here. So let's assume that B is bigger than 0. So now, if you have a finite system, then your magnetization, which is the average of the spins, so sigma I, is just, you know, sum over all the spins divided by number of sites. So this is just 1 over n, and then sum over all sigma I. This is what you mean by this average here. Okay, so now let's calculate what is the probability that you find all the spins up versus the probability that you find all the spins down. Okay. Let's take this ratio where you take a probability. Well, not all the spins are up, but the magnetization is positive or negative. Okay, so if it's probability the magnetization is negative versus probability that magnetization is positive. So now I'll be using, what is that? Well, basically Boltzmann distribution. The Boltzmann distribution is the Gibbs distribution. So the probability is e to minus beta times the energy. Okay, so it's e to minus. So now let's say if all the spins are up, then this is minus m b m over t. And then if all of them are down, it's plus. It's e plus m b m over t. That's the difference between the energies of all the spins are up or all the spins are down, or e minus 2 m b m over t. Okay. So now you can take two limits. So in the first limit, so limits, two limits. So in the first one, you say, well, let's take first, let's switch off the external magnetic field. So first, B goes to zero, and then second, N goes to infinity. So this is your prediction. So if you take B goes to zero now, then you have e to minus zero, which of course is one. And then it doesn't depend on n. So your ratio here is simply equal to one. Okay. So what it means is that if you switch off the magnetic field, and so we didn't have to do this limit, actually this is true for any n, then actually, you can find equally probable the systems that all the spins are up or all the spins are down. So actually, the fact that I have drawn this thing here to be up is not entirely true. You could have also plotted it down, and it would be fine. So basically, the system, let's say for this temperature, I would have another branch here. And so for this temperature, the system would be sort of jumping from the up position to the down position and vice versa. So for a finite system, so for any n, the system is jumping up and down randomly. Of course, it jumps up and stays there for some time, and then it jumps down and stays there for some time. And you know, these timescales can be pretty long. But in average, if you take the average thing, then actually you get zero magnetization in average.
Doesn't gold jump cost energy?
Well, okay. So that's a good point. If you switch off the magnetic field, that it really doesn't. So because you are choosing a ground state here to be, let's say, all the spins are down. Okay, that's one, and it's your choice of the ground state, but you could equally choose them, all the spins are up. So it's sort of like a matter of choice of, you know, what we are doing. If you have external magnetic field, then yes, you know what the ground state is, because then you want to align the spin so that you minimize your energy with respect to this magnetic field. But if you don't have that external one, then it's up to you whether you are.
Is that a quantum effect? That can jump?
Yeah, sure.
So classically, they cannot jump.
Classically, so this is at finite temperature, huh? What happens? This is at finite temperature, so I think they can jump, right? Yeah, it's just a fluctuation. So the spins, you know, all the spins sort of fluctuate because of the temperature. So the only thing is that usually, you know, one spin fluctuates like that, the other one fluctuates like that. So in average, nothing really happens. But it may happen that suddenly all of them change and they align together. And yeah, then you can have this swap from one to another in some sense. So second, and so this didn't really matter. So this guy did not matter. And so this was actually true for finite system. True for finite system as well. So, you know, you can go up and down here. However, if you take the thermodynamic limit first, so first you take n goes to infinity, and then you would like to take b goes to zero. And so this guy is called thermodynamic limit, n goes to infinity. Then if I take n goes to infinity here, I get e to minus infinity, and of course that's zero. So the ratio is now zero. I'm thinking n goes to infinity first.
No, just the last statement you meant, when you said that did not matter, you mean?
So that was the first limit. So when I take b goes to zero first, yeah, right, then it doesn't really matter what n is.
Yeah, so it's true for infinite.
It's true for infinite, but also for finite. It's true for any n. Okay, maybe that's better formulation. True for any n. So for finite system, I can jump up and down. But if I take the thermodynamic limit, I have infinite system, then I cannot jump in, up and down. So the ratio is actually zero, so this will never happen. And so the system remains here, remains forever, if you want, in the state, remains in the state defined by B. Okay, so really, if I have infinite system and I put some external magnetic field, of course the spins want to align, so the energy is minimized. So now I switch off the magnetic field, and so that chooses, let's say, up thing here. If I switch off the magnetic field, then the system will stay here forever, and I have forever this ferromagnetic phase. So this is an important lesson here, is that actually the phase transitions are true and exist, you know, are well defined only in infinite systems. So the
how can we understand that non-commutation of the limits then?
Yeah, so they don't commute basically.
But what's the mechanism that it's working there? Because I don't know, I don't see physically.
So physically what you are saying basically is that if you have really, you know, huge system, infinite system, then it's very different to any finite system. So that's physically what's happening. So basically, as you are saying, well, if I have finite system, it may happen that all the spins will suddenly flip down. But if you have infinite number of them, then the probability that it all is zero. So really, infinite system is different than a finite system, and so you have defined phase transitions, strictly speaking, only for infinite systems. So all the finite systems can stay in that phase for some time, maybe the time of the universe, but then they may actually go to the other phase. So that's the most important lesson of this simple exercise. So phases and phase transitions are defined, are well defined if you want, only sharply only for infinite systems.
And but for example, one person can come and argue that, okay, I just saw a phase transition in my lab, and that piece of material, okay, has a thermodynamic limit of spins.
Uh-huh.
But
in practice, if the system is sufficiently big, then yeah, that would be a phase transition, and so you will observe a new phase, and because you know that phase will be there for the lifetime of the universe, then you will never see it flipping back to another phase or whatever.
Okay, so actually, what it's real is the finite system.
So of course, yeah. So we always deal with a finite system, but you know what I'm trying to say is that strictly speaking, you know, even if it's in this ferromagnetic phase where all the spins are up, it's not the final story. It's not the final word. So you see that system to be ferromagnetic with all the spins up, but you know that's good enough for your lifetime. But
okay.
Yeah.
The non-sharpness of phase transition.
When you start doing systems smaller and smaller, yeah, you can observe that. For example, here, really, in the first case, when you send this B equal to zero for a finite system, you really see if you have small system of spins, so that's like only a few spins, then you would see, you know, jumping up and down.
So
the average magnetization will be zero.
Which means for a few water molecules, there is no.
Exactly. So exactly. So people sometimes put it in the words like, well, what do they say? Is that Well, that many is different. That's the saying. So they say many is different. So if you have really many particles, their behavior is different than if you have only a few of them. So yeah. So you start seeing new phenomena if you have, you know, lots of particles, lots of, you know, big systems. You start seeing new phenomena, and as besides the phase transitions are the new phenomena which you start seeing. And you wouldn't be able to predict them if you study just the Hamilton's equations, you know, for each of the molecule in your system. You wouldn't see these things, right?
So for the second case, R equals 0, so if you went to B, your approach on the positive.
Yeah, well, I can flip it around. So as I said, so it's basically your, if you don't have magnetic field, it's up to you which you choose to be ground state, whether it's up or down. It's up to you because all of them. So if you have non-trivial B, then you have that. But here I'm saying that the magnetization smaller than zero is. So it's connected to the statement which I just said. So yeah, the B tells you which is the ground state basically. Yeah. Okay. All right, so now this is a very good approximation to study phase phenomena, and that's called mean field theory approximation. So part B is mean field theory. Or MFT. And so basically you have these, you know, very complicated systems where you have lots of interactions, you know, the spins can interact with all the neighbors and you know, maybe the interaction falls off somewhere, but there's lots of particles the spin is interacting with. But so this is a complicated problem in general. And so what people say is that let's replace all multiparticle interactions by simply averaging over all what's happening and taking an average field produced by all your neighbors. And so then you will be interacting just with some average field produced by neighbors. And then as you say, well, because my position is not special in the crystal, I will take the average field everywhere the same in the crystal. So that's the main idea. So mean field theory replaces interaction, multi-body interactions, body interactions, actions with an effective one-body interaction. With an average mean field. So that's the main idea, and it's of course it's an approximation, but really what I'm saying here is if I want to know how this spin J interacts with all the other spins, I just, you know, forget that there are some other spins, and I say, well, there will be some interaction from this guy, from that guy, from that guy, from that guy, that will cause some average field. So there will be some average field phi here, and so then I will just have like an interaction with this average field produced by all the other neighbors, and then I say this average field is the same everywhere in the crystal, basically. Okay. So. For the Ising model, this can be done very explicitly. Okay, so for Ising, you just do the following trick. You write sigma I to be sigma I minus the average of sigma I and plus the average of sigma I. Okay, so it's sigma I minus m. Sigma I minus m plus m. Okay, so that's definitely true. then we want to replace, so in our Hamiltonian sigma I, sigma j, so let's look at what that gives you, sigma I and sigma j. Okay, so it's equal to sigma I minus m plus m, and then sigma j minus m and plus m. Okay. And so this gives you sigma I minus m, sigma j minus m. And then you have two terms, and you have plus m times sigma I plus sigma j, and then plus m square. Hopefully that's correct. M times, hopefully it's correct. So now this thing, you say, well, if I have lots of things, then this is sort of describing a fluctuation from this average magnetization. It tells you that my spin at that given point actually can be different from the magnetization. Well, the actual every spin can be different from average magnetization, but in average it will be small. It's a fluctuation. So if I call this guy to be a fluctuation epsilon, then this is of the order epsilon square, and so you neglect that fluctuation. This is a fluctuation, and because it's of the order of epsilon square, then you neglect that.
It's minus m square.
You're right, because there's this cross term as well. Yeah, it's minus m square. So then you simply say this is a fluctuation which is order of epsilon square, which you neglect, and that's your mean field theory approximation. Okay, so let's see that really it gives us an interaction with external field. So now your Hamiltonian becomes, so it's this minus 1/2 jij sigma I sigma j. So it's minus 1/2 sum over ij jij sigma I sigma j, which I use over there. So it's minus 1/2 sum over ij, and then m sigma I plus m sigma j minus m square. Okay, so now, of course, and there's this jij still here. So now you are summing over I and j of jij. Okay, so now the useful trick is to say, well, let's introduce a new quantity j. So if I sum over, let's say, I of jij, well, this should in principle have an index j here. But of course, your lattice is uniform. So the thing actually must be the same for any j. So this j actually, the index j doesn't appear here. Okay. So this thing is, you introduce a new quantity j to be sum over I jij. Okay, so now you can do the sum here over the last term. So it's m squared is just a constant, so you put it out, and then you have jij, and then it just gives you, well, it gives you j times, but there's still one sum over j, so n times j. It's minus 1/2. And then it's n times j times m square, and there's a minus sign, so plus. And then the other term is still there, plus sum over I and j, jij, m, sigma I, and sigma j. So now jij must be symmetric in I and j. So if you have interaction between spin and I and j, it's really, you know, it matters how far they are, but it doesn't matter which one is which. So this is basically twice the same thing. So two times, and the other term is not there.
Minus.
Minus. Thank you. J just keep an eye on me, and there's also minus 1/2, right?
No, plus is fine.
Plus is fine. But there's no 2. So there was 1/2, but now there's 2 of them. So okay, so it's minus Jij M sigma I. Okay, and now I can use again the definition that let me sum this guy over J, and that just gives me J. So this is equal to minus M times J times sum over I sigma I, and then plus 1/2 M J M square. Okay, so this is your Hamiltonian now. And so now you see that before we had really multi-body interaction here, you know, each spin interacting with all the neighbors here. But now, well, this is just a constant, but each spin now interacts with this average field M, which was my field phi, which I did here, which is like an average field produced by all the other spins. So now we have one particle interaction with an average field. And you know, to get this, we just had to neglect the fluctuations of the spins. So in some sense, mean field theory is a clever way how to simplify your problem drastically, but at the expense that you are neglecting the fluctuations. Okay. So now this is very good approximation as long as you are far away from phase transition. So we shall see that actually, you know, exactly at a critical temperature, exactly at a critical point, the fluctuations are actually big, and you cannot neglect them. So, so for phase transitions, exactly, you know, what happens at the phase transition, the mean field theory will break. But for the other points, for the other, the mean field theory description is actually a very good one. Okay, so it's just this thing here. So now let me calculate. So let me use this statistical physics machinery, and let me calculate what is the corresponding partition function for this approximate Hamiltonian here. Okay, so I want to know a little bit about the partition function. Okay, so Z is, okay, so it's trace E minus beta H in the canonical ensemble. So now, what do you mean by trace? We know that if you are doing ideal gas or whatever in the phase space, it's just an integral over all Qs and Ps. Yes?
You can still simplify, right? Because the sum of the sigma I is just n times n.
So sum of?
Sigma
I. Yeah.
It's just n times.
Thank you. Thank you for that question. So, so I defined m to be sum over sigma I divided by n only for a finite system. Okay, so that definition was true for a finite system. So here I just treat m. You are sort of right, but I'll treat m as really something which I'm trying to find, and sigma I as my variables in the Hamiltonian. And so I will learn sort of later, you know, what is the relation between sigma I and m, if you want. So at this point I just say the average value of sigma I is m, but yeah. So, okay, so it's trace of minus beta h. It can be an integral over Qs and Ps if you are doing a phase-based thing. It can be really a trace if you are doing a quantum thing. But in our case, because we are doing classical thing, it's just a sum. So trace is you sum over everything you can find, and that's it. Okay, so this trace, what do you mean by that? This is a trace is a sum over all possible spins in your lattice. And so it's E minus beta h. So of course, what you mean by that is that you sum over the spins sigma 1 equals to plus minus 1, and then you sum over sigma 2 and so on, and all the way up to sigma n equals to plus minus 1 of e minus beta h, which sometimes people write. And so as a product of sums over sigma I equals to plus minus 1 over e minus beta h. Okay, so this is what we need to calculate. But in our case, this is quite simple. So now you need to use what your h is. So h is this minus mj sum over sigma I, and then plus that thing. So of course, this guy is just a constant, and you can take it out. So you can put it out of everything. So now we don't have space. This is, yeah, let me continue here. Set is equal to, okay, plugging our Hamiltonian, is equal to sum over, well, product of the sums e minus beta, and now our h is sum over j, and then what was there? It's minus mj sigma j, and it's minus 1/2 beta 1/2 n jm square. So this is what you need to calculate. And again, I have wrong signs probably. There's a minus here. No, it's fine. So this guy here is just a constant. I can take it away. So this is equal to e to minus e to minus n j m square beta over 2, beta over 2. And then you have to expand these terms. So what it means is you have this thing times sigma 1 plus sigma 2 plus sigma 3 plus sigma 4 and so on. But if you are looking here, you are always summing over each of these sigmas, right? So, but now these things actually factorize nicely because you have e to something sigma 1 and you are summing over sigma 1. And then you have plus e to sigma 2 and you are summing over sigma 2 and so on. So this thing actually is written as a product of I equal to 1 to n, and then you take sigma I equal to plus minus 1, but now e minus beta, plus m and j, and then sigma I, and the product of all of these things. So now this step, I have done a few things, so I really expanded this sum here, and then I noticed that I am summing over all these things here, and this is what you get. So now this is quite simple. Well, you can do this. It's just plus 1 or minus 1, so you have exponential of something plus exponential of minus something, and then looks like a cosine hyperbolic. So this thing equals to e to minus n j m square beta over 2. And then you have cosine hyperbolic, actually two of them, of this exponent, beta, m, and j. And then you have still the product here. And so because these cosine hyperbolics are all the same, then this thing will be 2 power n. And that's your partition function in this mean field approximation. So having the partition function, of course, the next thing you want to calculate is the free energy. So free energy F minus T logarithm of Z. And so you have two terms, one coming from the exponential, the other one coming from the cosine. So you have so it's a minus, so a minus minus is plus, so it's T N J M squared beta over 2, of course beta eats T, but that's okay, plus, which is now minus because of this minus and T, and then logarithm of 2 cosine beta M J. Okay, so this T eats that beta. It's just nj m squared over 2 minus nt logarithm of that thing. So that's your free energy. Okay, so now I can come back to your question. Is, you know, let's see how really the m is related. Well, what is the m? So now our free energy is a function of temperature, this is not B, it's a function of N, but also it's a function of this M. And so using the thermodynamics, you know that the free energy must be minimized. So we can find M by minimizing the free energy with respect to M. Okay. So to find M, we minimize free energy with respect to M. So dF over dM must be equal to 0. So the first term gives you MJ and M, and the other term, well, you're differentiating logarithm, so you get a 1 over cosine h in the bottom, and then you differentiate cosine h, which gives you sine h, so sine h over cosine h is tangens h. So this thing gives you minus njm minus nj and T. Okay, I'll write down what I have in my notes, and then you can either find a mistake or not. So beta M and J. Okay. So N probably has to cancel, so this is fine. Yeah. This is fine. So in other words, this must be equal to 0. So M is equal to tangens H of beta M and J. Okay, so this is your equation for M. So now you can find the magnetization from here. Of course, this is not a very nice equation to solve analytically, but you can at least draw some pictures as you are used to do in quantum mechanics when you are studying various potentials of Schrödinger equation. So I can plot how my tangents looks like and how my left hand side looks like. So graphically, this is my M. So the left-hand side looks like a straight line, and the right-hand side looks like a tangens. So plus 1 and minus 1, and then hopefully looks like something this. Okay, so this is M, and this is tangens H beta JM. And of course, the solution of that equation is whenever you see intersection of the two lines. So you see that we have three intersections. The first one is in zero, at zero, and then you have other two at non-trivial m. So m equals zero corresponds to the paramagnetic phase, and m zero corresponds to the ferromagnetic. And you see again, you have two solutions, m zero and minus m zero. Okay, so this would be the solution, and so really, you know, for given argument here, I'm finding the corresponding m zero. So now of course the picture doesn't have to look like as I draw it, but it can. The slope, well, you know, how much this tangent hyperbolic is open actually depends on its argument. Okay, so now the picture, in fact, actually can look like this thing here. And then the only intersection would be that in zero. So then I wouldn't have an intersection with M, and you would have something like that, and you would have only paramagnetic phase. So that's also possible, and it depends on the value of beta and J is. Okay, so how to find out whether there is an intersection or not, it's enough to study the slope of how fast the tangent's h actually is going at zero. So if it's going faster than m, then there will be intersection. If it's going slower, then there won't be. Okay, so for that, I can just approximate this thing by the first series in the Taylor expansion. So your equation basically is something like, well, this thing is just beta mj for very, very small m. So yeah, I'm interested in zero. And then the slope, of course, well, the slope of this is 1, and the slope of that is beta j. So now I'm saying if the slope of the tangent is bigger than this one, then there will be ferromagnetic phase. So in other words, this must be, and then we have ferromagnetic non-trivial phase, which it gives us that if t is smaller than j, then we have a solution m equals to plus minus m0. And if t is bigger than j, then we don't. So t is bigger than j, then only paramagnetic solution m equals to 0 exists. OK? Just to do the math yourself. So that means that basically there is a critical temperature when you can have the ferromagnetic phase and where you cannot. And of course, this critical temperature is nothing else than this j. So you realize that really there's a t critical which is exactly equal to j. And so if you are for t smaller than t critical, you can have the ferromagnetic phase. And you do have the ferromagnetic phase. And if it's bigger, you don't. OK? Does it make sense? Very good. And because this j describes the interactions of the spins. So basically, you know, the value of the critical temperature depends on how much, you know, how strongly the spins interact or not. Yeah?
For t less than j, you could still be in the
paramagnetic. In principle, you mean paramagnetic?
Yes.
Yeah, in principle, yes. But what we will show shortly is that it's unstable. So yes, you could be in principle, but it's an unstable solution, and the ferromagnetic one is the stable one. Yeah. Okay. So now, of course, you can. So this is your solution for m0, for basically fixing So J is our T critical and beta is the temperature. So J is something which we know is already fixed. And I can start changing beta or start changing the temperature. And I'll keep finding different M0. So then you would reproduce that picture, which I already plotted, that you know this would be our M0 for a given temperature. And then for a different temperature, you would have that M0. And for a different temperature, you would have that. So you can you know plot this if you want. So this is my M. And then, you know, for each temperature, I would have this figure here. Because M is continuous at T critical, this is called a continuous phase transition or second order phase transition. If it were discontinuous, if the order parameter is discontinuous, it would look like something like this. You would have a first order phase transition. And you can show that exactly maps to terminology which we done for thermodynamics when studying the Gibbs free energy. You can think of M as a derivative of Gibbs free energy, and so it precisely corresponds to the same terminology. So now what we will be interested in is really studying what happens to close to this critical point when you start developing non-trivial magnetization. And so I said, because it's second order phase transition, it should be described by these N-fest equations, but also more importantly, is described by so-called critical exponents. And so critical exponents describe properties of various physical quantities near the critical point. Near. No? Aha, sorry. Is the other one which is broken. So what I would like to do now is to calculate one of these critical exponents for you, namely that for the magnetization, how the magnetization behaves close to that critical point over there. So vicinity of critical point is described by critical exponents, described by critical exponents and so you'll calculate one of them. So let us consider the free energy again. And so you see that the free energy is proportional to n. So I can consider free energy per site, and it's like a specific free energy if you want. So it's F over n, and it's written over there. So it's J m square over 2, and then minus T logarithm 2 cosine H beta MJ. So now you know that close to that critical point, the magnetization is small. Okay, so obviously it's either 0 on the right hand side or it's really, really tiny on the left hand side. So you can actually do expansion of this free energy treating M as a small quantity. So you just do the Taylor expansion of this guy for M small. So now, of course, this is double Taylor expansion. So you first have to expand cosine H, and then you have to expand logarithm 1 plus something. So again, using Mathematica or Maple, this gives you JM square over 2 is the first term which we have there, but now from the expansion of this guy, it's minus 1 half, beta is 1 over T, so minus 1 half T, and then you have MJ over T square, that's my quadratic, and then you have quartic term 1 over 12 T MJ over 4, and then you have other terms. So that's a Taylor expansion for small m. So you can group the terms together. So first, notice that we said that J is actually TC. So I will, instead of J, I'll write TC now. And then, so TC over 2 and M square. And the first term gives you 1. And the other term, so we have M square, we have TC square over T square, and then T. So this should give you TC minus T. And then here, so this is T. And here, this gives you plus TC4 over 12 T cube M4 plus other terms. Okay. So that's what your free energy is. By the way, you can plot it, and now we can justify what I told you, that actually the phase, what happens with the paramagnetic phase for T smaller than T critical. So you can plot the free energy. And so let's plot it first for T bigger than TC. So this is my free energy as a function of M. So if T is bigger than TC, then this thing is, well, it's positive. And so you have positive something times M square plus positive something times M4. So everything is positive. And so you get just a boring behavior. This thing just goes up here. And so if you want to minimize your free energy, you see that the solution is precisely the solution which corresponds to M equal to 0. And it's precisely your paramagnetic phase. So now if you have T smaller than TC, smaller than TC, and again, you want to plot free energy. Then if T is smaller than TC, this guy actually is negative. So you have something negative times M square plus something positive times M4. So of course, this dominates for large M, but this guy dominates for small M. So you have more complicated behavior. You have something like, well, this dominates the M square term, but then M4 term starts dominating here. And so what you observe something like this. And so here is your paramagnetic phase. And you see it's unstable. And here is your M0, one of the minus. And that's your ferromagnetic phase. So really, the ferromagnetic phase for T smaller than TC has lower free energy, and that's why it is stable, whereas the paramagnetic one is not stable. Okay. So this justifies what you ask for. So final step is really to find what this M0 is from the free energy. So you could do it graphically, but let's do it now approximately in the vicinity of the critical point. So again, you have to minimize the free energy. So df over dm must be equal to 0. So df over dm, so we'll have term proportional to m and term proportional to m cube. So this is equal to tc 1 minus tc over t times m, and then plus tc 4 3t cube m cube, and this must be equal to 0. And from here, Well, okay, so 1m cancels, and then you have a quadratic equation for m, and you find that this m is like square root of 3, 1 minus t over tc under the square root. Okay, so that's your solution of the quadratic equation. So now you're really, you know, very, very close to the critical point. So you can say you introduced a small parameter, which is denoted small, usually by small t, and it's t minus tc over tc. So and this is small. Okay. So then you see that this m is actually proportional to, well, it's just sine screwed up here, but and there's the square root of 3. Well, that's why I write proportional, so I'll forget about square root of 3 just take the minus sign. So it's minus t, and of course, to power 1/2. Okay, so now you land that the magnetization close to that point, so as you have that picture here, you are really studying the vicinity of this point. So you learn that the magnetization behaves like the difference in the temperatures here to power 1/2, right? So it's a power law in the temperature, if you want, and there's this 1/2, which is very interesting thing. So this guy is called the critical exponent, and in our case, it's called beta critical exponent. Critical exponent beta. And so what it describes is how really the magnetization behaves close to the critical point, or more generally, the beta critical exponent is the critical exponent for the order parameter. For order parameter. More generally, so in our case, the order parameter is the magnetization of the stuff. And so what we learn that for the Ising model, the beta is equal to 1/2 in the mean field theory approximation. So now, why are the critical exponents so big deal? Is that actually it turns out that you have so-called universality classes. And so you can have systems which have nothing to do with each other, which look completely different. So you can have water and you can have ferromagnet. And you know, close to the critical point, however, they behave universally, meaning that they always behave like the order parameter is minus t to power beta. And if they are within the same universality class, they have the same beta. Okay, so that's what you call universality of critical of phase transitions, of second order phase transitions, is that you find so many systems which seemingly have nothing to do with each other, but they have the same critical exponents. And so in that sense, the second order phase transitions are universal. So maybe let me stop here today, and tomorrow we will calculate some more critical exponents for other quantities close to the critical point, and then we will move to field theory.